My lords, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honour to be here and to start us off with a little bit of history. As a bit of a Whitehall watcher over the past 40 years, I've been struck by how revealing reviews can be about particular areas of public policy. Their frequency, their patterns, their overlaps and their underlaps can tell quite a story and serve too, as I hope they will this evening, as a stimulus for questions and observations. For example, by my calculation, the current so-called capability review of the 2015 Strategic Defence and Security Review is the 13th defence review since the Second World War. The current industrial strategy, hovering between its green and white paper phases, is the 8th since 1945. There has, by contrast, been only one comprehensive review of welfare and deprivation in the round in the lifetime of some of our fellow countrymen and countrywomen, and that was the Beveridge Report of 1942, 75 years ago next month, in fact. How interesting it is that thanks to the exercise in documentary cartography that the Foundations Dougal Goodman and Darren Strong have undertaken, we can, as you can see from the timeline in the handout you have, identify at least 20 science and innovation strategies of various kinds since the war, and that isn't counting the ones mounted by individual government departments. And a quick glance at the timeline will show you how their frequency has picked up since the early 1990s. Suffice it to say that several generations of our best political, scientific and official minds have pitted themselves against the bundle of problems we're examining this evening. Given the uncertainty we are facing as a major making, trading, thinking and innovating nation this time, somehow we must surpass the performance levels of the past on several fronts. Happily, there may even be an embryonic political consensus on these aspects of our national endeavours, if on few others. There is, too, a strangely ethereal quality to all of this. For Gareth Davis and his team at Bayes are crafting the forthcoming industrial strategy white paper in rooms, I think, haunted benignly by the wraiths of the framers of the strategies of the past, flitting around with sympathetic looks and rueful smiles playing across their pallid faces. For there are certain crucial elements that touch all their sepulchral minds, problems and needs with which they all, without exception, wrestled. Have a listen, for example, to the first of the post-war line, the Barlow Report on Scientific Manpower of May 1946. It was quite a committee that produced it. Its members included Edward Appleton, Patrick Blackett and Solly Zuckerman. Its scientific assessor was C.P. Snow. And here's its opening paragraph. We do not think it is necessary to preface our report by stating at length the case for developing our scientific resources. Never before has the importance of science been more widely recognised, or so many hopes of future progress and welfare founded upon the scientist. By way of introduction, therefore, we confine ourselves to pointing out that least of all nations can Great Britain afford to neglect whatever benefits the scientist can confer upon her. If we are to maintain our position in the world and restore and improve our standard of living, we have no alternative but to strive for that scientific achievement without which our trade will wither, our colonial empire will remain undeveloped, and our lives and freedom will be at the mercy of a potential aggressor. Now, if you strip out the references to the colonial empire and Joseph Stalin, that, I venture to suggest, could pretty well serve as the opening paragraph of the forthcoming white paper. It would still fit. We can, I think, pick out three crucial themes that run through our score or so of reviews, especially the cataract of them over the last 25 years, and I'll see if I can bring them up. First of all, funding. A running theme has been the difficulty in meeting the stated aspirations of successive governments to raise government spending on science, research and innovation as a percentage of GDP, and particularly to encourage the private sector to follow suit. The second one is commercialisation, the industrialising of our scientific prowess. From the days of Barlow in 1946, there has been at best a mixed picture and at worst a continual struggle to take the world-class ideas created in UK science and innovation to market by converting them into patents, paving the way to commercial opportunities. We have not done well in comparison to many of our leading international competitors of long standing. The same is true for a number of more recent competitors too. Third theme that runs right through: skills, higher education and productivity. Productivity gaps that yawn between ourselves and our chief competitors ring out as a prime anxiety in all the industrial strategies since the annual surveys produced by the Attlee Government Central Economic Planning Staff and the Anglo-American Productivity Councils pushed so hard by Sir Stafford Cripps when he was Attlee's Chancellor of the Exchequer. The same note of anxiety rings out from the latest industrial strategy too, and the OECD highlighted it only yesterday. Huge effort has been put into skills training. The great Robbins report on higher education in 1963 placed eloquent stress on the need for more science and technology courses and graduates. Today, the skills, scientific and technical education elements remain a prime concern, with enhanced performance ever more vital in a technologically leaping and ever more globalised world. And in their recent examination of the latest industrial strategy, the House of Lords Select Committee on Science and Technology, of which I had then the honour to be a member under John Selborne's excellent chairmanship, we had quite a sense of the past and its pluses and minuses when in our report we stressed the potential benefits of a vigorous industrial strategy with science and innovation as its pervasive themes, as we put it. In one sense, this exercise by the Foundation for Science and Technology emerged from the Select Committee's inquiry. Now, you may think that we've had a plethora of variegated inquiries and analyses of the problems over the past quarter of a century, but the thought occurs that we've never had for science and technology and innovation a beverage-style examination embracing in one sweep the whole breadth of those problems in the round and isolating the concerted and simultaneous action required to break through the crust of underperformance. Perhaps the closest we've come, and this is why in many reasons I'm delighted he's with us tonight, is Michael Heseltine's 2014 report on growth, no stone unturned, which he'll be telling us about in a minute. The older of you may remember that the key to beverage, mind you, you have to be quite old to remember the beverage report when it came out, but anyway, you may remember that the beverage report concentrated on the slaying of what he called the five giants on the road to reconstruction, and he put them in capitals: ignorance, idleness, squalor, disease, want. Just think, if you wrote a white paper like that today, you'd be offered counselling at the very least, wouldn't you? It sold 700,000 copies. It's a bestseller, parachuted into occupied Europe in translation. Quite extraordinary. But Beveridge's argument, which I think is relevant to our theme tonight, was that unless all those five giants were smitten and struck simultaneously, the crust of poverty would not yield. Now, a Beveridge for science, technology and innovation, it's just a thought. If one was forthcoming, it might help too to achieve another great prize, which was highlighted on the July 2000 document, which is in the sequence of reports, if I can get it to work. I think we might have jammed. No, we haven't. There we are. Excellence and Opportunity, a Science and Innovation Policy for the 21st Century. Now, what prize was that? The way it was put in that document was the creation of a society that is confident in its relationship with science. We've never quite achieved that in my lifetime. That's a great prize. Now, that would require a particularly buoyant, perhaps almost poetic form of language in a Beveridge-style report on science and technology and innovation. All too often, Whitehall reviews concentrate, understandably, on the plumbing rather than the poetry. There's very few lines they leave that cling to the Velcro of memory. Certainly no five giants. Plumbing, however great its importance, rarely appeals to the imagination. I remember a wonderful line of R.H. Tawney's: only those institutions that are loved appeal to the imagination. And the same applies to white papers. Along with the paper you have this evening and the timeline of reviews, you have details of those reviews in there and an account of the organisation of state-funded science from the creation of the modern research council structure following the Science and Technology Act 1965, which was based on the Trend Report of 63, right through to the creation of UKRI this year. The work that's reflected in the documents you have is work in progress by the Foundation, and we would value your input, not just this evening, but in the weeks to come. You may draw very different lessons from history than the ones I'm drawing now. You may hear, in fact you will, you may hear and see different things when you eavesdrop upon and examine the efforts of the past. And indeed, we are standing on the shoulders of several giants. Getting this right, to state the obvious, has been and must remain a great national endeavour. I would humbly suggest, very humbly, that history, knowing just a little bit about how we got to where we are today, can help. I've never believed there are any iron laws of history, but there may be some non-ferrous metal laws. And Mark Twain put it rather well once when he said, history may not repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes. And I think that's profoundly true of what we're looking at this evening. Several strategies stand out as significant milestones passed by successive governments over the last 50 years. The Rothschild and Dayton reports recommendations were accepted by the Heath government and implemented in the 1972 Framework for Government Research and Development. The customer contractor theme, which many of you will be deeply familiar with, remains contentious today. Who should decide what are the priorities for government-funded research is an ever-present question. Miles Parker, the former Deputy Chief Scientific Advisor at DEFRA, in an excellent paper, which I found fascinating, reviewed the impact of the Rothschild Report of 1971 on the management of research and the struggle for the scientists to participate in policy development in departments. Rothschild recommended that chief scientists should be appointed in departments to act as the customer for research rather than chief scientific advisors who have an explicit role in advising ministers. And Miles concluded, and I'm quoting him now, Rothschild never really addressed the question of the function of scientists in government policy-making departments. His mind was wholly focused on research, not only because of the question put to him and the central policy review staff, if you remember, which was Ted Heath's creation in the Cabinet Office, but also because of his previous Shell experience as Director of Research. Industry is actually very forward-looking, said Miles, and willing to wait for research results to flow in, but policymakers in general cannot afford to wait for the slow products of research to emerge. A week is a long time in politics, as Harold Wilson may have said. And politicians need the best available advice now to take action on the policy problems of today. End of quotation. The 1993 Realizing Our Potential for Science, Engineering and Technology document refocused attention on cross-cutting funding of research to improve competitiveness and the quality of life. And a spin-out from the review was the establishment by John Major of the Office of Science and Technology in the Cabinet Office and the Technology Foresight Process, which successfully brought together end users to articulate what they wanted. By 2000, there was a shift in the attitude towards scientists. The seminal House of Lords Select Committee report on science and society, chaired by Lord Jenkin, a former chairman of the Foundation, promoted the idea of a two-way dialogue between scientists and the public, which of course is still a critical theme. Over time, the emphasis has subtly shifted from talking about science, then science and innovation, and now to productivity improvement. And it's always the same, mind the gap, to use the language of the London Underground. The 2006 Next Steps report on the Science and Innovation Framework set out the arguments for companies to stimulate investment in innovation and the establishment of a technology strategy board, which later became Innovate UK. And as Minister for Science in the Blair government, Lord Sainsbury kept attention on the importance of funding for science and innovation during the financial crisis years with his Race to the Top report. The recommendations were accepted and the Innovation Nation strategy with it. And David Willetts, who I'm delighted to say is also with us this evening and going to speak, Science Minister in the Coalition, successfully defended the research and innovation budget at a time when all departmental budgets are being cut by 20-30%. And Paul Nurse's review set out recommendations for radical reform of the research councils, which were put into law in the Higher Education and Research Act of 2017. And on the 1st of April 2018, next year, as we all know, UKRI will be up and running, bringing together the seven research councils, Innovate UK and Research England. However, discussion of how departments are managing their research programs should not be forgotten. Now, to sum up, this is a fascinating 70-plus years story of high intentions, great expectations, and sustained attempts to find a holy grail that would somehow bring all the ingredients into a shining synthesis that would close the ever-stubborn productivity gap and transmit ripples of stimulus into the research and development community, into the private sector ever more closely, and enliven the non-scientifically trained minds in Whitehall and the Cabinet Room, all the while kindling the mind of Parliament and the public into an ever greater appreciation of the benefits of research for society. And when you think about it, it was always a tall order, and it still is a tall order, turning our research into comparative advantage in the global marketplace. We all know that money is tight, and we have to squeeze every ounce of value out of the science budget, and particularly the extra £4.7 billion that John Selborne mentioned to be spent over 5 years, announced in the 2016 Autumn Statement. Government, as Nye Bevan once said, of socialism is all about the language of priorities, and setting them is always stretching. This evening, just briefly, we've been eavesdropping a little on the best efforts of past generations. We owe it to them to build on what they achieved and what they showed us and reach for a new way of working together. Perhaps striving for a new national trajectory, and indeed a great national endeavour in pursuit of a more vibrant economy, rising productivity, and a sustained betterment of our society. Thank you very much indeed.